As we start this second part of the talk, I thought I'd put up the chart, which is the complete idiot's chart to understanding the Middle East. So this is a very simplified version of the different relationships between the different parties who are at present engaged in the Middle East. There are a lot of other relationships you could put in, but it would come so thick with different arrows that you wouldn't be able to see, understand a thing. The main thing is, if you look at it long enough, you realize there's no end of contradictions. One country will support one country and then another, and then it will hate another country and so on. So you get quite confused as to who supports who and why. Like Qatar and Saudi Arabia both hate Iran, but then they're supporting different sides of the Syrian conflict, you know, and why are they doing that? And it goes on and gets more complicated. Quite a good one, though, is the United States and the blue arrows towards the Muslim Brotherhood and Sisi, which is don't know. Many years ago, I read a book by a French diplomat, Pierre Rondeau, it was written in 1957, trying to explain all the things which had gone wrong in the Middle East just after the Suez Crisis. And what he said about it being a French diplomat was the French got it completely wrong in the Middle East. The British sort of understand and then made a mess of it, but the Americans never, ever got to grips with the Islamic mindset. They just couldn't figure it out. And I'm sorry to say, that still stands true today. It's where we are. So anyway, that's the simple idiot's guide to what's going on in the Middle East. In the first talk, I presented how the Muslim Brotherhood wants us in the West to see it. You know, this benign institution, mainly charitable, seeking the good of the ordinary people. In June of this year, after Morsi had been in office less than a year, a petition was organized in Egypt, which received 22 million signatures asking for his removal. Remember, he only got 12 million votes to put him into power, and now 22 million people signed a petition to get rid of him. And on the 30th of June, an estimate, some say as many as 30 million people turned out on the streets to say, get rid of Morsi. They were so fed up with him after less than a year in power. And in the next... That's a picture of the people on the streets. And the next day, the offices, once again, they were burnt down as protests about the Muslim Brotherhood spread throughout Egypt. And as we know, the army stepped in to remove Morsi. Now, unfortunately, there are still people calling it a military coup. It's not a military coup. When you have 30 million people saying, please do something about this man, he's so awful, it's not a military coup when the government steps in. What many of our politicians refuse to recognize, because they don't like the truth of this, is that in any democracy, you've got to have a backstop. If an elected government moves beyond its mandate and starts governing at will, disregarding how it got elected, then there must be a backstop which can remove them. That's essential. That's one of the most important aspects of a democracy. In Britain, the role of removal is to the Queen. Some of us wish she had removed some of the governments which have been elected in the past, but she is the backstop. She is the one who's has her principal constitutional position is that once the government loses the support of the people, when it moves outside its elected mandate, they should be dismissed and new elections held. Well, Egypt didn't have that constitutional framework. And the only power which could possibly remove Morsi against this background of such hate was the army. Therefore, I don't believe it was a coup. It was a response, a necessary democratic response to a government which was not governing in accordance with the mandate which they had been given. But what went wrong for Morsi? Was he just plain incompetent? Well, he was. Or was he being true to the ideals of his party? And the problem for him is that when in office, he spent his time focusing on things like revising the constitution to make it comply with Sharia law, and putting more and more of his own people, his Muslim brothers, into power. And he didn't tackle the issues which had caused the Egyptians to throw Mubarak out. He didn't tackle high unemployment. He didn't tackle rising food prices. He didn't tackle a stagnant economy. All these things, nothing was happening about. And so he failed on that account. He didn't really intervene and do the things which the people were really looking for a leader to do. So, in fact, Morsi was being true to the Muslim Brotherhood's real ideals. So we can look below the surface and see how the Muslim Brotherhood presents itself to its Muslim supporters. And it's different from how they would like us to understand them. We'll start with the insignia of the Muslim Brotherhood. It's on a green shield, which is green because Muhammad's favourite colour was green. Cross swords are for jihad and the picture of the Quran above. So it's firmly based on the Quran and the cross swords of jihad, waging war to spread jihad. I was hoping that Mike, Arabic speaker, might pronounce the words, but he said he's so rusty. But Wadu, is that... Wadadu. Right, that's the word on the shield. And it means prepare. Prepare. And it's short for the Quranic verse, prepare against them as you're able a force and cavalry to terrorize Allah's enemies and yours. So prepare. It's in other words, get ready for war. Get ready to defeat Allah's enemies. That's what the battle cry on their insignia is. The main motto is Allah Islam Hua Allah. No, I don't know. Which means Islam is the solution, which I said earlier. You know, that's the founding principle of Al-Banna's movement, believing that Islam could solve the problems of the world. So Islam is the solution. And then a full version of that is Allah is our objective, the Prophet is our leader, Quran is our law, jihad is our way, dying in the way of Allah, our highest hope. So it expresses an underlying belief that violence is justified to bring about their vision of an ideal world. I thought to illustrate what they actually believe, we'll just look at one of their publications. And this is called Jihad is the Way. It's the title of a booklet published by Mustafa Mashur. Mashur led the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood from 1996 to 2002. And the booklet was translated into English by Palestinian Media Watch, from where I got this information. So in his booklet, Jihad is the Way, Mashur explains the fundamental concepts of brotherhood ideology. He covers such topics as the establishment of the Islamic State, world domination under Islam, public and personal duty of military jihad, and warnings not to rush into jihad until it's prepared and time for maximum benefit. So again, emphasize that's one of the distinguishing features of the Muslim Brotherhood. You bide your time and wait for the right time. So I'm going to run through a few quotes from the book which give an idea of the Brotherhood's real ideology. The book opens with a call to a renewal of faith, a revitalization of Islam in order to restore it to be first among the nations. Its aims are summarized in the first quote from the introduction to the book. Jihad is the way. We need to be fully aware of this and act and follow in its way. The faltering faith of faith has led the Muslims to their current state, one of laxity, disintegration, the dominion of Allah's enemies over the Muslim resources, and the succumbing of some of them to abandoning their faith. The revival of the faith is the starting point for the revival and revitalization of the Islamic Ummah nation, broad unity of all the Islamic peoples, so that it can regain its power and be liberated and assume its rightful position, which was intended by Allah, as the most exalted nation among men, as the leaders of humanity, and through this religion of truth, they will deliver humanity from darkness unto light. So there's his objectives. That's what he's saying it's all about. Delivering humanity, bringing in a new world order, but a different type to some of the politicians dream of. So, how will Islam be restored to this preeminence? The methods outlined in the booklet are summarized in the following quotes. The Imam and Shaheed, that's martyr, Hassan al-Banna, writes in his treatise on jihad, "All of the sages, the earlier and the later ones, agree that jihad is a religious public duty to spread dawah, that's the word for Islamic missionary activity, incumbent upon the Islamic nation, and is a personal duty to fend off the infidels' attack on the nation. The Muslims today, as you know, are humiliated by others, dominated by infidels. Their land is overrun and their holy places are desecrated. Therefore, there exists an unavoidable personal duty for every Muslim to acquit himself and prepare and gear up towards jihad until the opportunity arises and Allah will determine his word. So drive out the infidels from the Arab lands." In the section with the title Muslim Brotherhood's Stance Regarding Jihad, we read the rejection of negotiation and the call for aggression. So this is another quote. "Jihad, for Allah's sake, has been forcing itself upon the Islamic region in recent years and has become tangibly noticeable in parts of the Islamic world. In other parts of the Islamic world, there is a tide of preparation for jihad and the sense that it is unavoidable and is the only way to retaliate against the aggressiveness of Allah's enemies and to liberate Islamic land from its occupiers and invaders. It has become a widespread and convincing opinion that the way of negotiation and peace treaties with Allah's enemies instead of jihad is surrender in the name of peace." So yeah, you are. Any negotiation with the infidel, us, is just surrender. It's not going to achieve anything, is what their view says. Walid Shubat and many others have said that the prime purpose behind the establishment of the Muslim Brotherhood was to restore the caliph. That was their main objective, which is right, it is. The English propaganda of the Muslim Brotherhood vigorously denies this. They say it's nothing to do with what they're about. They're a charitable, benign organization, and caliph has nothing to do with their intentions. So there's another quote which clarifies what the Muslim Brotherhood really believe. Remember, this is all what written in Arabic, and so few Westerners actually read Arabic or understand it that they get away with writing one thing for their own followers and another thing for us. So this is another quote. "Additionally, without jihad and the preparation towards it, the obligation cast upon every Muslim to establish an Islamic state and the Islamic caliphate and to consolidate this religion will not be realized. In the English propaganda, it's denied that al-Banna had an interest in restoring the caliph. In Arabic, al-Banna is cited as the inspiration for action." So another quote. "He, Hassan al-Banna, felt the grave danger overshadowing the Muslim and the Muslims and the urgent need and obligation which Islam places on every Muslim, man and woman, to act in order to restore the Islamic Caliphate and to re-establish the Islamic State on strong foundations, and to liberate the Muslims and defend them from any attack, and to spread Dawah, Islamic missionary activity, of Islam in the world, and to establish this great religion which Allah wanted for his servants. So there are many Muslims who claim that jihad is just inner renewal, it's a change in heart. But the next quote clarifies that to the Muslim Brotherhood, jihad is military action. In all this, Hassan Albana's writings and conversations, he always urged towards jihad and aroused the desire for seeking shahada, martyrdom. He did not content himself only with speech and writing, but when the opportunity arrived for jihad in Palestine, he hurried and seized it. The Muslim Brotherhood provided the most magnificent models for jihad and courage, and were it not for the evil scheming and treachery on the part of the leaders of the Muslim countries of the time, the situation would have been different. So note the attitude towards their leaders back in 1948. They saying, you know, it's because of the compromised, westernized leaders that they failed to achieve their objective. So this aggressive understanding of jihad is reinforced by the next quote. Jihad is not only for repelling an assault, but also for the purpose of establishing an Islamic state. It should be known that jihad and preparation towards jihad are not only for the purpose of fending off assaults and attacks of Allah's enemies from Muslims, but also for the purpose of realizing the great task of establishing an Islamic state and strengthening the religion and spreading it around the world. And then the book goes on to say the duty of jihad will primarily fall to Islam's youth. The following quotes are a call to rise up in the cause of Islam. After this preface, we turn to the Muslim youth around the world with advice and focus on the path of jihad. We say to the youth, know that jihad in the way of Allah will be, Allah knows, the most prominent characteristic of Islamic action during the next phase of the Islamic Dawah. That's the missionary spread. And Allah's Dawah, Islamic missionary activity, will reach all mankind. And the youth should know that the problems of the Islamic world, such as Palestine, Afghanistan, Syria, Eritrea, or the Philippines, are not issues of territories and nations, but of faith and religion. They are problems of Islam and all Muslims, and their resolution cannot be negotiated and bargained by recognizing the enemy's right to the Islamic land he stole. Therefore, there is no other option but jihad for Allah, and this is why jihad is the way. And then he writes, so that the women, Muslim women, are not feeling left out, he says, and you, the Islamic sister, on the path of jihad, you have an important role in jihad, which starts at home, educating the young generations and preparing them for jihad. The woman is the producer of the men, and Muslim women used to teach their sons by heart the stories of the military expeditions as they would teach them the Quran. In addition, the Islamic sister who lives by the spirit of jihad is a help to her husband, encourages him in the path of jihad, and she doesn't turn him away or weaken him. Likewise, she promptly manages his possessions and children and takes care of them while he's away on jihad. So, yeah, the women should be supporting the men and encouraging them to fight these battles for Allah. The book concludes with the words, work for an honorable death. You will be thus granted full happiness. May Allah provide us and you the honor of achieving shahada, martyrdom for him. So there's a very different picture to that presented by the Muslim Brotherhood to the West. It's totally different to their public image. The goal sought by the Muslim Brotherhood is to establish the caliph and then bring the whole world under Islamic rule. Now, at this point, I would emphasize that the Muslim Brotherhood is not an international conspiracy. It's actually, its international network is very weak. What we're talking about is the power of an idea. It's the idea that Islam can regain its former position, that it can have a leader who will unite it. Instead of tearing itself apart, they'll have a leader who will unite it and restore their position in the world. And I attribute the modern rebirth of Islamic fundamentalism very much to Hassan al-Banna. He's the one who really started drawing it together, started giving it a voice, starting to pull it together. Others have been many, many offshoots, but I think he's the one who really sort of achieved, you know, the organization, the movement, which we now see bearing fruit throughout the world. So it is literally a beast with the image of the dragon rising from the sea, as described in Revelation 13. As we see it rise, I'm going to make a statement which many would perhaps not agree with as yet, but I believe we will see the whole world being amazed. The more power Islam gains, the more the world will follow after it. So what are the consequences of this Islamic revival? There are some who say that Islam will overreach itself and collapse. And some actually see the reversal of fortunes which characterized Morsi's fall as the beginning of that collapse. Well, I disagree. I think it's not going to collapse. And it may take time for the Muslim Brotherhood to recover from the current setback. But you've got to remember, the Muslim Brotherhood is not just in power in Egypt. There's another country with far more influence and much stronger, which has a Muslim Brotherhood government. And it's Turkey, which is the country to watch. Sorry. I've jumped ahead and realised I missed out a statement, because talking about Egypt, what has happened in the recent months, though, is that the Muslim Brotherhood has shown its true colours. In August alone, 60 churches and 4 monasteries were completely destroyed as Muslim Brotherhood supporters went on the rampage. They wanted to blame someone for the overthrow of Morsi, so they took it out on the small Christian, Coptic Christian community largely, and other Christians. So that's just a picture of a burnt out church. I mean, there are many other pictures we could show. They started to show their full colours, the true nature. But Turkey is really the country to watch. It's seeking to establish itself as the leader in the Islamic world. It perhaps has a sort of lingering feeling that, you know, for hundreds of years it was the leader, it was the central power in the Islamic world, and it wants to recover that position. That's a map of the world as seen by Turkish Muslim author Adan Oktar. He's an incredibly influential person in the Islamic world. He has a huge publishing house and produces hundreds of titles, magazines, newspapers, all sorts throughout the Islamic world. And that's what he believes is coming about. This will be the Turkish Islamic Union, and that's just the beginning, of course. They'll establish that when they get a caliph, and those are already largely Islamic areas, which most of them, some of them are not, most of them are largely Islamic areas, which will come into line once they have their caliph, the leader. So it will rebuild an empire which stretches from the Atlantic to the Pacific. The historian Niall Ferguson, in an interview with the Daily Telegraph two or three years ago, said that a Middle East with a restored caliph was possible by 2021. And in 2005, a report was issued by the US National Intelligence Council, which is a center for strategic thinking within the US government, reporting to the Director of National Intelligence, and providing the president and senior policy makers with an analysis of foreign policy issues that have been reviewed and coordinated through the intelligence community. report entitled Mapping the Global Future Project 2020 predicted that within a few years we may expect to see the emergence of a revived Islamic caliphate. So they studied the situation in the Middle East, and they too believe that the caliph will arise before long. See, in the West, we need to recognize it's not democracy that the Arab world and the Muslim world is crying out for. They're looking for a strong leader which will recover their pride. They've been crushed. They've been humiliated by the West. They want someone who now restore their pride. That's what they really long for. They want security and stability. I believe that when that leader comes, the West will actually welcome him. When that leader comes who unites these peoples across the continents and provides security, the West will say, yes, at last he's starting to sort out all the problems that the world has been struggling with for so many years, and they'll welcome him. So, according to my understanding, and I know my understanding is a little controversial, the events we are witnessing and have witnessed over the last few years are paving the way for a world leader, an antichrist. He's coming from a different source to what others say. And I don't insist that my way is right and others are wrong. All I say is, I offer this to you and we'll see. We'll see. But I believe we will see Islam gaining in strength. We will see a leader arise who is accepted. I do another talk, well, other talks, where I will tell you that I believe actually he will come and fulfill Islamic eschatology, that study of the end times, where they believe there will be a miraculous appearing. But that miraculous appearing ties in very closely with what the Bible teaches about the coming of the Antichrist, with signs and wonders from Satan. And when he comes, a man like that who comes, who will unite the Islamic world, who will unite other religions, he will wow the West into believing a great man has arrived. The West and all the nations will follow him. But let's go back to Turkey. I said earlier, though I missed the slide and got in the wrong order, the secular state of Turkey was set up by Ataturk. And the army was given the role of protecting the secular constitution. In other words, the army's role was to stop it reverting to an Islamic state. So that was given their role. So while the Arab Spring was going on, all this turmoil in the Middle East was in progress, the Turkish newspapers reported 163 people arrested. Well, that was completely missed by the Western press, because other things were happening in Egypt and Libya and all over the place. So all sorts of things were happening. They missed this. But what had happened was that Erdogan, the prime minister, had done a coup against the army. These 160 people were all the top brass of the army, navy and air force. And I won't go into all the details, but by a cunning ploy, he got them together and then swooped and arrested them all and shipped them off to prison. So he, in one swoop, removed the constitutional check against him taking the country in the direction he wanted to take it. Well, Erdogan's Justice and Development Party, the AKP, was born out of the Welfare Party, the RP, and both are rooted in the Turkish Muslim Brotherhood. That's where they get their ideology. So the Welfare Party was known as being anti-Western, anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, anti-European, anti-democratic and anti-secular. Well, the AKP, after some problems, the RP was forced to sort of disappear, and the AKP came in its place, denying, telling everybody that it had changed. Well, in reality, it hadn't changed at all. So although it was re-emerged in 2001 as a reformed party, jettisoning the previous policies in order to gain power, it actually, on gaining power, soon returned to its Muslim Brotherhood roots. So Turkey outwardly retains good relations with Israel and the USA. Well, the good relations are not so good now, but still not impossible. But if you go inside Turkey, you'll find Israel, the USA, the European Union are increasingly demonized. And so Erdogan has removed the check on his power, the check which stopped him turning Turkey back into an Islamic state. He's removed all effective opposition, which is exactly what happens wherever the Muslim Brotherhood gains power. It happened in Gaza under Hamas, and it happens now in Turkey. It was happening, one of the reasons for protest in Egypt. It was starting to happen in Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood removes all opposition. And so the principal opposition to Erdogan turning Turkey back into an Islamic state has now been removed, and he is moving ahead. He's getting away with it, though. See, Turkey is prospering. They've had growth over the last 10 years. And that's what Morsi missed. If you are riding on the back of a strong economy, plenty of jobs, rising incomes, plenty of food, then you can start doing the other things. Bring in your Sharia law, bring in your other restrictions, because people are generally happy. They're getting, well, you know, they're prospering. And Turkey has prospered. Morsi, in Erdogan's opinion, should have spent time healing the economy of Egypt. Then you could move into these other things. We started to see why Walid Shoubat described the Muslim Brotherhood as a rising dragon. He went on to call this dragon, which trumpets non-violence, as the form of Islam which we in the West really need to fear. Because it says it's non-violent, but as we've seen in Egypt, once it gets the upper hand or when it gets into position, it turns very violent. Jesus said in Matthew 7, verse 20, "You will know them by their fruit." And despite all the words the Muslim Brotherhood might have, all its propaganda in the West, the fruit very clearly tell us that it is a rising dragon.